Welcome to Theatre Voice. My name's Heather Neal, and I'm at the National Theatre in the Olivier exhibition space, where there's a special exhibition at the moment of West End Theatre in the 19th century. With me are Judith Bottomley, local studies librarian at the Westminster City Archive, the source of many of the playbills, maps, costumes and other artefacts which make up the exhibition, and Robert Tanich, whose book London Stage in the 19th Century is newly published by Carnegie Publishing. Well, before we look more closely at a few of the exhibits, Judith, could you give us some idea of the extent of the archive, the kind of things it contains?
Right, well, the City of Westminster Archive Centre is the official repository for City of Westminster's historic records. So, first and foremost, we're a local government record office. However, with the presence of the West End at the heart of Westminster, we've obviously got a very extensive theatre collection as a way of protecting the heritage of our local area. So the theatre collection, it's mainly paper-based, i.e. consists of playbills, programmes, sketches, drawings. And at the moment, we've got up to about 2,500 playbills dating back to the 17th century. We've also got a large number of programmes, theatre programmes, mainly for West End theatres. It extends London-wide, and we have those covering over 100 theatres. The advantage of Westminster City Archives is that it's a completely publicly accessible archive.
So anyone could go in?
That's right, that's right.
Not just for researchers?
That's right. So anyone who's got a family connection in the theatre, is just a theatre lover, likes going to performances. Architects, for example, might use our collections to look at theatre plans. So there's really a lot of opportunities for people to explore. We don't operate on an appointments basis, so people can just drop into us as they like.
That's fantastic. Well, Robert, you're well known as a writer of theatre books, and in fact had published already a book about theatre in the 20th century. And I believe you came across the archive while you were working in Westminster Library.
Yes, I've been going to Westminster Reference Library, which is off Leicester Square, for at least 15 years, doing partly my research. I also naturally use the Theatre Museum. But the Reference Library in Leicester Square is excellent. And I'd done some research there, obviously, for my last book on the 20th century, London Stage on the 20th Century. And the chief librarian there asked me, he said they were having a little tiny exhibition and perhaps I'd like to comment on it and give a little introduction and say how useful their library was. And I said, well, of course, I'd be delighted to do that because, I genuinely feel that, And I arrived, and it was a very tiny exhibition. It was full of these fantastic posters and photographs, and I didn't know them. I did not know them. And I said, where is all this? And they said, it's in our archive. And I said, well, this is fantastic. Can I meet you? And so the chief librarian met me, and I said, I've just done a book. He said, yes, I know. I said, I think I might be able to do a book on the 19th century with your archive. So he said, well, I think you better go and check the archive first. I checked it and said, there's more than a book here.
Great find.
So, I'm thrilled, and I'm in theatre, and I, feel that the archive deserves a lot of publicity.
Yes. So, well, that's great because it's now got this exhibition as well as your book. I think perhaps we should give people some idea about what theatre was like in the 19th century. Of course, 100 years is a long period and it wasn't the same throughout. But I'm just going to read a quotation which comes from the book, and it was printed in The Observer. Which had some tart comments about theatre throughout, didn't it?
But the critics were really vile in the Victorian age. I mean, I think they'd be even libelous nowadays, personal comments, and this is quite the norm. We're very tame nowadays.
Yes. Well, this says, as long as splendid scenery and gay costumes are made more important than poetry, social poetry be kept in the background, and our national drama necessarily be in a depressed condition. Splendid scenery and gay costumes are unavoidable in a large theatre, and hence we are opposed to them, because they are opposed to poetry. That was in 1837. Well, that gives us some idea, Judith, doesn't it, about the enormous size of many of the theatres. They were huge, weren't they? And so the performances were big.
Well, certainly, by the latter half of the 19th century, when the Licensing Act was revoked and more competition.
Yes, that was an 18th century act, wasn't it?
That's right. So in 1843, the act was repealed, and it meant that whereas certain, well, just really two theatres in central London, Theatre Royal Drury Lane and the Royal Opera House that we know today, had a patent to display spoken drama.
Yes, it seems odd to us that you actually had to have a licence for spoken drama, but it was all right if you put music into it.
Yes, I mean, as far as I'm aware, it's to do really with trying to prevent public uproar, really, and riots, etc. Because I think spoken drama was seen as a threat because it often had a very political message behind it as well. It was a way of controlling dramatic performance in London at the time. So once that act was revoked, then suddenly there was much more competition, and theatre could really take off as a commercial enterprise in London. And so there was a lot of speculation, financial speculation in theatres, a lot of money available for capital investment, and huge palaces, entertainment palaces sprung up across the city. So yes, I mean, certainly nowadays we do think of progress in terms of size and scale, but actually a lot of these 19th century theatres were housing 2,000 plus spectators anyway. Right back in those days.
Yes.
And also we're looking at a period where technical innovation was really key at the time. There are innovations in lighting, in the way that scenery could be changed around, yes, in the theatres.
The hydraulic bridge.
That's right. Yes. So actually in the exhibition we have some photographs of the restoration of a hydraulic lift in Theatre Royal Drury Lane, which was restored just a few years ago. And it's a mechanical lift which allows the stage to tilt, to come up at different levels at different stages. So it was a real innovation at the time and really helped the way that performance developed.
Yeah. Well, Robert, they were used to spectacle, weren't they? Spectacle was very important, and also influenced perhaps the kind of audience you had. It wasn't always respectable to go to theatre.
Well, if you've got a theatre of over 2,000 up to 3,000, you've got to provide an entertainment for that audience. Yeah. And that audience in that size theatre cannot be preoccupied with subtleties and needs truly the word sensational stuff.
Yeah.
And in fact, writers like Dion Bisico wrote sensation scenes. Yeah. And that's why we have melodrama.
Yes.
Because it can allow for the big performances that the actors had to give. And at the beginning of the century, you know, people like Sarah Siddons, who came from the previous century in her heyday, is still giving these big performances.
Yes.
And, you just have to do that. And theatre has to be popular.
Yes. So the kind of people who went to the theatre were not necessarily the respectable middle classes then, were they?
The respectable middle classes stopped going to the theatre because it became too popular.
And there were riots sometimes.
Riots were quite regular. Fires were quite regular. Instead, it's one of the hazards of going to the theatre in the Victorian age. Not just in England, around the world. Opera houses were being burnt down regularly and people were losing their lives, you know, and obviously fire regulations and health and safety were things unknown.
Yes. Well, there were famous riots at Covent Garden, weren't there? So that was after a rebuild, after a fire, I think.
Yes,
and they raised prices to pay for the rebuilding,
yes,
which caused riots.
That's it, and the riots lasted for days.
Days.
And they actually read the Riot Act out from the stage in an attempt to put an end to the...
But people went along to the theatre to be a riot, in fact.
It's interesting.
They did because they made so much noise that not a word of the plays could be heard.
It sounds like sort of football misbehaviour. Well, maybe we should talk about one or two of the huge characters from the people we still remember, and we're actually quite near a case which shows a costume worn by Irving and a caricature of him, amongst other things. The costume is from Henry VIII, Shakespeare's Henry VIII, in which Irving played Wolsey. And it's rather beautiful, isn't it? This, I believe, is not one of yours, is it?
This has been kindly loaned to us from the Mandarin Mitchison collection. They're based out in Greenwich, and they've got a very extensive collection of original costumes. Yeah. So we're very lucky to be able to display this. It's paired with, at the other side, a Sarah Bernhardt costume, which has also been on loan to us. So, yes, it's absolutely... We're really honoured to be able to display Henry Irving's original Cardinal Wolsey costume in this exhibition.
It's extremely detailed, isn't it?
It is. We've got his cape, his hood. We've also got his shoes on display there, which gives you an idea of the size and scale of the man. And we've managed to actually get from our own collection the original programme from this very production. It was a revival of the play in which he wore this costume, and this is also from the 1892 revival of the programme.
Right. Next to it, sorry, Robert.
I was going to say, this is a typical play of the period. Henry VIII, in our own century, we don't really think much of the play.
No, although it's on at the moment.
Such a rare thing.
It is a rare revival.
And the thing has always been that Wolsey has always been the role that has attracted the great actors. Yeah. But it is, again, the spectacle that the people have enjoyed. And in the same way that we put on Henry VIII for Queen Elizabeth II's coronation, so they put on in the Victorian age for the various coronations or patriotic occasion they'd revive Henry VIII.
Ah. Well, beside the costume is a famous caricature of Irving in a role, which probably people know a quotation from, even if they never go to the theatre. The bells, the bells. And the caricature shows him playing the part of Matthias. This is in your book, Robert, isn't it?
I know. I long for a real proper production of this play. And if they're going to do it, I just hope they're not going to send it up. We have an awful habit of taking over melodrama and thinking, you know, the way to do it, no audience will take it seriously. And so we must, you know, we will encourage the audience to boo and cheer and various other things and make noises. It's a great part, it's a great role, and I think some great actor of our own time should take the risk and do it properly and hope that the audience will behave. Instead, I mean, you know, melodrama. I mean, Hedda Gabler's melodrama, you know, has a bad name, melodrama.
It's quite true, actually. Yes, it means music and drama, and you don't even need to have the music. Well, he acted frequently with Ellen Terry, didn't he?
So, yes.
And we have some examples of Ellen Terry on the other side of this case, as we're walking around now. Yes, she was sort of the country sweetheart, wasn't she?
Absolutely. Judy. I mean, 19th century really sees a true celebrity culture being spawned in theatre. So Ellen Terry really captured the heart of the nation. She was known for her openness, her open character, her sweet-natured character. Nevertheless, she definitely had stage presence, and her sort of acting method was usually to internalise the personality of her character and think how she would act in those circumstances. So people often criticise, saying, oh, Ellen Terry plays Ellen Terry, but actually she was thinking about her own emotional reactions to the circumstances of the role that she was playing. So we've actually got a souvenir from her Jubilee commemoration for her 50th birthday, and it was issued at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane, and it's these sort of souvenir programmes which actually just commemorate these prolific actors started to be produced in the very late part of the 19th century. So you have one for Eleanor Terrace, for example, who was another great, she was a great musical comedies actress. Ellen Terry also, people would collect a lot of memorabilia and postcards. They were really fans of her.
Well, not far away from here, there's a poster for Nicholas Nickleby on the wall. I don't know if people realise that the RSC's famous Nicholas Nickleby wasn't the first time that that was done on stage. In fact, Robert, Dickens used to have his work whizzed away from him before it was even finished.
I know, it must be absolutely infuriating. He actually did complain about it, but of course there's no copyright. No copyright, you can do what you like. Mm. And so coming out in magazine form, Nicholas Nickleby was a great, great success. And actually, I think he did like this one, because the lady who played Smike was incredibly good.
And this was in the 1830s?
Yes.
Right, now, there are other famous... Sorry.
I was just going to say that, of course, Dickens's novels are melodrama.
Yes, yes.
They are absolutely.
And we enjoy them on television.
And we enjoy them enormously on television. And we enjoy adapting him to this day, as it were. And so if melodrama is popular in the novel, it is not surprising that it is popular, even more popular on the stage.
Well, perhaps at this point we should mention someone who changed the direction somewhat, Tom Robertson. I don't think we have anything of his here, do we?
I don't think we do, actually.
but I'm sure he's
I'm
in
sure
your
he's
archive.
In the book,
he's certainly in the book.
And he's in your book. Because he changed the direction of theatre somewhat, didn't he?
He is as important in the Victorian age as John Osborne was in the 1950s. Yes. Yes. He brought a new realism. And in set and in acting, he didn't want stereotypes. He wanted real people. He wanted real doors, real windows, real furniture.
Yeah. Yes, people may know of him from Trelawney of the Wells, Pinero's play.
Which is a delightful play, much loved by the profession, and it does give an idea of the theatre in the time.
Remember one character in that describing the work now as terribly liney, because there were no big speeches.
That's right. It was naturalism. He was after naturalism. And people like Gilbert, W.S. Gilbert, Savoy Operas. Yeah. Gilbert, as a young man, watched Tom Robertson directing and said later that he'd learned a great deal from him how to deal with actors.
Ah.
And interestingly, one knows that Gilbert was a tyrant with the actors. They did exactly what he wanted them to do to the last movement. Robertson wanted actors to do what he wanted them to do, because he was always frightened that the actors would start acting in inverted commas, and so he'd hold them down and make them play it for real. And he created a whole company of those actors, which were absolutely fantastic.
Right. Well, you've got GNS in the archive too.
Absolutely.
Haven't you? And we've got them here too. Shall we have a look at them?
Yes, certainly. So Gilbert and Sullivan. Yes, they first met actually. Well, they first worked together at the Gaiety Theatre, and they worked on a play called Thespis. It was a musical entertainment that was produced, commissioned by John Hollingshead for Christmas. And after that meeting, just started off a wonderful collaboration, quite a stormy collaboration by all accounts. But they went on to produce many, many different productions, among the most successful being Pirates of Penzance, Pinafore, Patience as well. And they were also one of the playwriting partners which managed to span the Atlantic in terms of popularity. So in certain cases, for example, the Pirates of Penzance, I believe, premiered at the same time in Paignton, New York and London. And part of that was actually to protect their rights in the work, because it was too easy for other people to start pirating their plays across the Atlantic otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Again, Heather, Gilbert is known for Gilbert and Sullivan. Actually, he was quite a good writer in his own right, and perhaps we ought to have a look at one or two of his plays just occasionally. Engaged, which was done recently at the Orange Tree, is absolutely delightful and charming and should be much more in the repertoire.
Yes. Yes, you're quite keen to have a proper revival of some forgotten 19th century.
Well, I think if my book has a purpose, I think is to remind readers and theatre-goers and theatre practitioners that there are some people, there are other people besides Oscar Wilde. Yeah. And
yes, I should say that the book is an extremely detailed chronology, so that year by year you know what is on and who is involved, and there are some wonderful photographs. That's one of the nice things about this period, of course, that the beginnings of photography really finding its feet. So, I mean, we've got here, for instance, Beerbohm Tree as Shylock. I mean, I almost laughed there, you see, because they do look very melodramatic, but then... Go on, Robert.
Well, I was going to say that Shylock is a melodramatic play. Though they were starting, of course, not Beerbohm Tree, but actors were starting to play Shylock not so much as a villain, for sympathy.
Yes.
And were heavily criticised for doing so.
Yes. I think Irving was one of the front runners in that, as I understand it. Irving suddenly, he wanted to portray Shylock as someone who'd been wronged by society. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, yes, a lot of criticism was levelled at him at the time for that.
It's interesting sometimes, Heather, to read the critics in the Victorian age, and a reminder how we all get it terribly wrong, and what they liked, and they thought Twelfth Night was a dreadful play, for example, or not very good. And, you know, it's one of our favourite Shakespearean comedies today. So our taste does change.
Yes. Well, maybe we should mention a few other important characters before we finish. Actor managers, for one thing. Was there something
else? Well, I was going to say, we're looking at Boussicault.
Before we move on, Boussicault has just been put on here in London Assurance.
And the National has done some of his plays.
Yes, the Chocron as
and,
well.
You know, and he's usually very popular, and I think he is another writer where we could look at some more of his plays, and they are worth reviving. And again, they should be, I think, revived with affection rather than the intention of saying, OK, Victorian melodrama, let's end it up. Let's try and do it seriously.
Yes.
We were quite lucky at the moment. The National's running its excellent production of London Assurance that ties in with our exhibition. And, that's actually, you know, it's an excellent portrayal of a presentation of his work.
And so he was a writer keen on spectacle too, wasn't he?
Yes, and quite sensational in his own life as well, as I understand it.
Yes.
I
think.
Incredibly prolific, yes.
We started talking about actor managers then. That was a... We don't have so many of those now.
The important actor manager who was much criticised in his time was Charles Kean, who used to put on Shakespeare productions. And okay, he did them in a spectacular way, and he cut the Shakespeare to allow for the spectacle. But as people actually who thought about it realised that people who would not have gone to the Shakespeare if it had not been for the spectacle. Mm. And some of the productions that I read about today are absolutely, the spectacle is stunning, and we would really be quite impressed, you know, if the National Theatre put on that sort of spectacle.
Are you talking about scenery? Or
I'm talking about
costume?
Scenery and the sheer numbers on the stage and the battle scenes and so, and the tableaus are absolutely fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And he himself was not the son of a very famous actor, Edmund Kean, at the beginning of the century. Very, very famous, wonderful Shylock, etc. He was not considered a great actor, but he was considered a great actor manager.
Yeah.
And certainly he brought the public into Shakespeare. Yeah. And for that, you know, you ought to be thanked.
Well, I was interested to discover that there were some married couples who were managers, weren't there?
Charles Kean and his wife, Ellen, worked together. Madame Vestris and
Charles Matthews.
Charles Matthews. Thank you very much.
Where were they? Where was Charles Matthews and?
I believe they were at, I think they were at various theatres
over
time.
They were at a number of theatres, yes. And they were responsible, of course, for one of the key features of Victorian theatre pantomime. And again, spectacle. Dance, music, but beautiful, evidently, from what one, you know, can read of the descriptions, absolutely extraordinary.
Yes.
I'd love to see somebody try and recreate a Victorian pantomime, and with the Byron's dreadful puns. I mean, you know, I mean, Tom Stoppard enjoys puns, so I don't see why the Victorians shouldn't enjoy it.
It's quite interesting that actor managers, it gave certainly women a chance to head up a business at the time. So Madame Vestris at the Lyceum, for example, was greatly praised for her management and being actually able to put new life into the theatre when she took it over. And I think, you know, at that time there were very few professions in which a woman could really say, I'm a manager of... I'm a manager of this business.
She was splendid. Of course, the sadness, of course, is that she was so interested in artistic things that she went bankrupt a number of times, which, again, is a reminder. And Charles Kean, who I was just talking about, did not make money out of the Shakespeare, you know, because he was employing vast numbers of people and so on, so that they didn't make, you know, you tend to think of actor managers nowadays, you think of them having a fortune. I mean, they did okay, but not wonderfully.
Yes.
And were in danger.
Murray Wilton was another person at her, about, wasn't she? As an actor manager.
Oh, as Mary Bancroft. She married
Squire Bancroft.
Squire Bancroft. Are the discoverers of Tom.
Tom
Robertson.
Yes.
And they, again, they made the theatre very respectable. And they, are, I think, are the beginnings of what we would call society drama, you know, the well-made play, in inverted commas.
I don't think we ought to finish without mentioning Sarah Siddons, who kept...
I'm sorry, forgive me, there's one person Robert, I would really like to mention, is Ira Aldridge. Because
you're right, yes, we mustn't miss out Ira Aldridge.
Because I think you're about the only person I've talked to who immediately knew who Ira Aldridge is. Ira Aldridge is a fantastic black actor who left the United States to come here because of racial prejudice. Yeah. He arrived here, and the racial prejudice which greeted him is appalling, and it's so appalling. I've quoted it in great detail in my book because it is so revealing. But he was such a good actor, that he could play white roles, and he won the respect, not only in Britain, but all across Europe, and even in Russia.
Yes.
And he's a great, great actor.
That's a lesson, though, for people who think that we're terribly modern in being able to do that.
And
it's just it didn't catch on very much, did it?
And because of the emancipation of slavery, the number of plays about slavery at the time is enormous. Right. So when we say the theatre was frivolous and melodramatic and spectacular, it was these things, but it had dealt with issues that mattered, like slavery, for example.
That's good. Yeah. Sorry, Judith.
Well, we've actually worked at the archives quite closely with Leon Robinson of Positive Steps, which is a large black theatre archive, and at the archives, for example, we've got a playbill with Morgan Smith, who is a very prolific black actor in the 19th century, in the 1860s. Quite a rare playbill that actually shows him in portrait, in profile, on the playbill. So it is interesting when you go back, and it is a hidden history, actually, the history of black performance in Britain in the 19th century, but it's something that should be explored, as Robert says, in much greater depth.
I think it should be explored in much greater depth.
Yes. Well, having mentioned Sarah Siddons, I've got to go back to her now, because I love the idea of her playing, coming back and going away again, coming back and going away. She retired so many times, didn't she?
But the sad thing is that every time she came back, even the critics of the day who adored her kept on saying, oh, please don't,
yes,
please
don't
come
back.
But I can understand actresses wanting to come back.
Yes, she was most famous for the sleepwalking scene in Lady Macbeth, wasn't she?
Oh, certainly. It was revived many times.
You know that on her official first farewell, she played, when they got to the sleepwalking scene, obviously that's her last scene, so the play stopped.
Yes.
And so anybody who'd come actually for the play had to come on another night. Which I don't know if we would dare do today.
Well, we could go on for another hour and a half, I should think, but perhaps we should finish on Sarah Siddons' farewell and say goodbye too. But Judith, you want to?
Oh, Heather, I'd just like to say a couple of acknowledgements to people who've loaned materials to us for the exhibition, particularly the Theatres Trust, members of the Association of British Theatre Technicians, and, of course, Mandarin Mitchinson.
Yes. Okay. And we should also say that Robert's book is on sale in the bookshop here and elsewhere, of course. Otherwise, get in touch with his publisher, Carnegie Publishing. And to see some examples online, some pictures, people should go to your archive, Tudor.
That's right. If they visit www.westminster.gov.uk, they'll find a link to our archives catalogue. Searching under Theatre Collection should bring up a whole host of images that have been published in Robert's wonderful book. And they can either explore online or come in to visit us. Just drop into the archives and we'll help them on site.
Okay.
Could I reiterate just one final point, that I do hope that...
We've got as many farewells as Sarah says.
I do hope that the exhibition, and possibly my book in a little way, will encourage the theatre practitioners to relook at the period. I think it's about time we did.
Yes, good. Thank you very much. Thank you both.